Our guest today, Sonny Rollins, is on the very short list of the greatest tenor saxophone players ever, along with John Coltrane, Coleman Hawkins, and others. 76 years old, he began his recording career in 1949 and last year released a new album called Sonny, Please. Playing early on with Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk, by the late 50s he was considered the greatest player of his time. Then he took the first of two sabbaticals from playing because he didn't feel he was good enough. This tireless striving to never play the same thing twice continues to this day. Now, even if you aren't a jazz fan, you know Sonny's playing from the Rolling Stones hit Waiting on a Friend. As a man whose music is always improvised, therefore always changing, I ask Rollins how he views making a record as opposed to playing a concert.
Well, ultimately, I guess it becomes a snapshot. But when we go into the studio, I'm not thinking too much about it. I'm thinking about trying to deal with the music at hand. And, you know, sometimes we have to do multiple takes to kind of get the best take. So that sort of occupies my time, really, when I'm in the studio.
This I wanted to play the first piece on the album, Sonny, Please. And when I see that title, I was just wondering if that had anything to do with your wife.
It had a lot to do with my wife.
Would she say that a lot?
Right. Well, you know, when we would be in discussions, you know, it was she would say, Sonny, please. You know, so one day she said that, Sonny, please. So I said, wait a minute, that's a good title for this. I just started playing the song, which had no title. So she said, yeah. And I said, yeah, that's it. So that became Sonny, Please, which is his first composition.
Well, it's a good one. And also, Clifton Anderson is your
nephew.
Nephew.
Yes.
Clifton plays the trombone on this. And let's listen to a bit of our guest today, Sonny Rollins' composition, named by his wife. This is Sonny, Please. Track of a new album from our guest today. Sonny Rollins is our guest on The World Cafe, and it's on his own Doxy label, which if you are a fan, you'll realize is an earlier composition from Sonny. I'm sorry. It's rare that I get an opportunity to talk to somebody who has been through so much history as you have and been had such an interesting life. I'd love to just talk through some of the high points of your career and your life. But I do want to go all the way back to growing up in Harlem. Your parents were from St. Thomas. Did you grow up in an area where there were other people from the Caribbean?
I think Harlem had a contingent of people from the Caribbean and people, you know, sort of. It was Harlem was sort of the people were drawn there. You know, the black community sort of was established in Harlem. So people from all over came to Harlem. It was a wonderful place, really, because so many musical influences, you know. I mean, I heard so much music when I was growing up, you know.
Was there a, I mean, the place of jazz in the world was different then. Everything kind of flowed from jazz at that point. I mean, you grew up at a time where the greatest players of whatever instrument you want to name were out there. Was it around you all the time growing up?
Yeah, it was. One of the greats, the great greats, Fats Waller, the pianist, I think he was the first guy that I sort of remember hearing when I was really almost in the crib, you know. And I heard him a lot. We used to have a player piano in the house. You know, these pianos that play rolls, what they call rolls, by themselves, you know. And so I think I had a lot of James B. Johnson. I heard a lot of him, who was sort of Fats' teacher, right, the stride guy.
Stride piano player.
So I was just born at the right time in the right place, you know. Everything was around me. Fats Waller used to play right across the street from where we lived at the Lincoln Theater. He used to play live there for movies and all this stuff. And I was just in the middle. The Cotton Club was right up the street. I used to pass the Cotton Club going back and forth to school. The Apollo Theater, of course, where I got my musical education, really, being there every week, you know. And so it was a fertile place for jazz music.
Am I right that Louis Jordan was an important figure for you at that point?
Very, very important figure. My uncle's girlfriend had a lot of Louis Jordan records, you know. That did it for me, you know. I think I must have liked the saxophone. And that was it when I heard Louis Jordan.
Now, you getting your first horn, was that a big event in the house?
It was a big event because, of course, we weren't affluent people, you know. So my mother, I actually had an uncle who played alto saxophone. So my mother was able to go to him, and he sort of got us this secondhand alto saxophone, you know.
Were you happy with the alto, or you knew you wanted a tenor?
Well, at that time, I was happy with the alto. I was just beginning to be aware of Coleman Hawkins. Coleman Hawkins was a guy that sort of got me into wanting to play the tenor. But at that time, I was quite happy with the alto.
And if you look at your career, some of your first dates, I guess the Babs Gonzalez dates, where you were a teenager. Was it easy for you to break in because of your talent, because you were in the right place, or what was that like?
Well, I think I was, I guess I had some talent. And the people and the older guys, like I lived in an area they called it Sugar Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the great musicians lived up there, all of the guys. So we used to be standing on the corner, you know, and watching all these guys, Coleman Hawkins and John Kirby and Erskine Hawkins, Andy Kirk, and all these guys going and coming. You know, this was really Jimmy Rushing. So eventually we got good enough with our little kid band. You know, we got good enough to be known. Everybody was talking about, oh, yeah, you know, this little band. And so the older guys, like Babs Gonzalez, for one, found out about, you know, who's this young kid supposed to be good, you know, Sonny Rollins. So he heard me, gave me an opportunity. And a lot of other guys, like Kenny Drew, the pianist, he was in our kid band, and he got a chance to start playing with some big name people, you know, Ben Webster and all these different people. So we just got known by the older people in the neighborhood, and they began to recruit us, really, you know.
Our guest is Sonny Rollins, the great saxophonist, and we were talking a bit about the earliest parts of his career. And you went on to play with just a whole slew of wonderful people, Max Roach and a lot of great bands at that period of time. And you started getting a name, and I'm sure you've talked about this a lot, but there were two periods in your career where you moved away from playing. Took a hiatus, took a sabbatical, however you want to express it. And one of them, the first one was starting in 1959. Did you, each time you did that, did you do them for the same reasons or for different reasons?
They were for different reasons. In 1959, I was beginning to get a big name, in, you know, in the jazz community.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been a heavy practice. I mean, I've always considered myself a guy that's not a work in progress, so to speak.
You're not there yet still.
No.
Yeah.
No. And to this day, I mean, I practice and I'm not there yet, you know. Mm. So anyway, I was getting a lot of publicity, and I remember I had a band. I remember exactly the particular night that I reached the end of what I was doing. I had a band with Elvin Jones. As a matter of fact, we came through Philadelphia and we picked up a guy named Jimmy Garrison. And, you know, that's how we were doing. Elvin and I would. So anyway.
I should say, people who may not know, that's one of the great rhythm sections of all time that you happen to pick up.
That's right. That's right. It became Coltrane's rhythm section. Yeah. So we had a gig that night, and you know, Big Sign, Sonny Rollins, and all these people were really anxious to come and see us. And I really didn't satisfy the people. I didn't satisfy it myself. I mean, just I wasn't there yet where I wanted to be. So I said after that night, I said to myself, okay, that's it. I'm going to go back into the woodshed, you know, practice room, so to speak, and try to get myself together.
And what was the difference the second time that you...
Okay, the second time, I think it was because of the music business. The music business is a pretty rough business. So that was part of the reason. So I was, at that time, I had begun to investigate Eastern philosophy. And I was reading a lot of yoga books and Rosicrucianism and everything. I began to trying to learn about something to kind of nourish my inner self, you know, not just about making money or trying to make money and all. I mean, I want to find out what it was all about, you know. I went to Japan and so on. Took up Zen Buddhism in Japan. I met a guy over there who had a yoga school, became involved with that school, learned yoga, and then finally I went to India.
It's interesting, as somebody who does what you do, which is to be a master improviser, which is about staying in the moment with your horn, whatever the situation may be, I would think that that level of spirituality and the things that you would get from those would be almost crucial to what you do. What do you see as the connection between spirituality and music?
Well, is a lot of connection. But it's interesting that you say that because at that time I was in India. My teacher went over there at the ashram that happened to land in when I was over there. I told him, well, you know, it's difficult for me to sit down in a lotus pose and, like, still my mind and just meditate. So he told me, he said, well, Sonny, you know, never mind that. He said, when you play your horn, that's meditation. That's meditation. So you're already meditating in it, you see. And this was sort of, I mean, now it seems simple to say, oh, sure, that is. But at the time, it wasn't clear to me, you know.
Well, one of the things you're known for is doing a lot of unaccompanied solos. You know, obviously solo with whatever group you're with. But does that relate towards getting to a higher place also? I mean, it seemed to be pretty free. You could do, you know.
Right. Well, you know, as a child, when I first got my alto saxophone, you're talking about, I used to go in the room and, like, play for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, my mother had to call me, Sonny, come in and eat, you know, all this stuff. So I would sort of, even at that age, I would be doing, like, a stream of consciousness playing.
Sonny Rollins is our guest. And one of the things you're also known for is taking songs that weren't necessarily part of the jazz repertoire. It might be more too pop or too, you know, and using them. I mean, there's no reason not to, but people didn't always do that. And so I thought I'd play Surrey with the Fringe on Top from going back to Way Out West, which is the one from the tune from Oklahoma. How did you come to pick that? You just like the changes?
I like the changes. And, you know, growing up, I used to listen to the radio a lot and go to the movies. And that was our form of entertainment, edification, I should say. So that's all we had. And I heard a lot of these show tunes. And I always feel there's good music or bad music in my, you know, what I like is either I like some music, I don't care the style. And that's all. That's my distinction, good or bad.
Well, here's a good one. This is Surrey with the Fringe on Top. Guest Sonny Rollins, and that one goes back a ways to the Way Out West disc, and Surrey with the Fringe on Top. Sonny Rollins is our guest today. He's got a new album. His first album in 5 years came out last year called Sonny Please. I did want to ask you another question about spirituality, because when you were on your quest around that time, maybe a little bit later, John Coltrane is well known as being a person who went through a lot of spiritual changes and certainly affected his playing. Did you have conversations with Train about that?
Oh, sure. We used to talk about those things quite frequently.
Were you on similar paths?
Well,
you didn't end up necessarily in the same place, not musically.
No. We were separate individuals, but I think we had an understanding that there were some things in life which were greater than what we saw, you know. And so we discussed this a lot and exchanged books and everything, you know. And it was, you know, it's great to know somebody like John Coltrane. It was, you know, really another privilege.
Speaking of taking things to another level, you I was looking at your schedule for the summer and the coming months, and
when you work, you play fairly major concert halls. You don't play clubs. And I'm assuming that that's your choice. Does that elevate the music to a different place?
Well, that was a choice that my wife and I made. We were in concert on that. We wanted to elevate jazz to a more respectable place in the society. So I was able to do it. We deprived ourselves of certain material things, but we felt that that was important. So I didn't play any clubs. I stopped playing clubs and only played concert venues, and hoping that that would elevate the opinion of people about jazz, you know, and give jazz a chance to reach. And you know, I mean, in some ways it might have been fanciful because it might not have changed. But in another way, I think it did do a little bit to elevate the, at least myself. I stopped playing clubs. I played in concerts, and I felt grander, you know, about it. So I'm sure it had some effect.
You made an album called, I think it was called Freedom Suite at one point, which got re-released with a different name because people, I'm not sure exactly what the politics of all that was. Mm. But, and you have always been, if not quietly, vocally pro a lot of African-American causes, political causes. Did that... I understand your mom, a lot of that came from her side of the family?
My grandmother.
Oh, really? Your grandmother?
My grandmother was an activist, you know, and she was involved with Marcus Garvey, and we used to be in parades up and down Harlem for Paul Robeson and a lot of these causes, you know. So I was, from an early age, I sort of... joined the struggle for equality. I've learned a lot about the reasons why equality is so difficult to attain, you know. But it still is, it's a part, I mean, I believe in it. And so I made the Freedom Suite back in 50-something. And I made The House I Live In. And then I also did a song called Arigin, which was Nigeria, spelled backwards. It was sort of a call way back in 51 to get black people to sort of think about Pan-Africanism.
I understand you were at a point, ended up at an integrated high school, which was unusual at the time, and Frank Sinatra came and sang?
Exactly. They integrated a school on the Lower East Side of New York, not the Lower East Side, sort of 116th Street,
yeah.
Which was
Upper
Little
East Side.
Italy,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And this might have been the first integration. I don't know, but it was a big new school. And so they bussed us down from up in Harlem, Sugar Hill. And the community rebelled, you know. I mean, here's all these black kids coming down, and this is our community. You know, this is the way the world is. It's the way America is. I mean, this is tribalism, which is the biggest problem the world faces, tribalism. But anyway, so they, you know, there were a lot of conflicts, people throwing stuff out the window at it. I mean, just a lot. So Frank Sinatra came down. Of course, he was a big hero then, especially in the Italian community. So he gave a concert in our school auditorium, you know. And then the next week, Nat King Cole came down, the King Cole Trio, and gave a concert. And it cooled the atmosphere. Things were much better. People began talking to each other. Things got along. And... It was great.
Wow.
So artists, I feel, have a social responsibility if they can help make things better, you know. But
well, chalk up one for music on that. That's
definitely
great.
Definitely.
That
Well, you know, I was funny. You talk about bringing people to jazz and bringing people to your playing. I was thinking we might go out with something that people who may not even think they know Sonny Rollins will know. And I wanted to play something from the Tattoo You disc from the Rolling Stones. People may not be aware that the saxophone solo on Waiting on a Friend is you. And what's the story behind this? How did this come about?
Well, my wife was a good fan of the Stones, really. And there was a chap in England who I did a film for a long time ago, and he was a good friend of Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger wanted me to do this record with him, you know. So I was ambivalent about it. I mean, it was, but my wife said, no, you should do it, you know, because I like the Stones. So I said, well, who are the Stones? You know, something like that. But you may not heard of them, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, then it was a challenge to me to see if what I did could fit with what they did.
That's what I was wondering about, yeah.
Yeah. See, and this is, to me, this is a big thing, to be able to make music with everybody, a universal music, if you want to put it that way.
Watching girls pass by, it ain't the latest thing. I'm just standing in a doorway. I'm just trying to make some sense out of these girls passing by. The tales they tell.
Sonny Rollins on that saxophone solo from Waiting on a Friend with the Rolling Stones, and great to hear the story of that one from Sonny, and great to have him as my guest, Sonny Rollins.